Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola Cairncross. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Steph, Heather, Linda, Pat, and Teresa. Ladies.
Hi.
This week on Write Club, it's all about Black History Month. But also, I'd just like to tell you that we doubled our listenership over the summer.
Oh, wow.
Which Fantastic. Is astonishing, and I keep forgetting to mention it. We don't know what happened. We think it might be, you know, postcards, people reading on the beach, people looking for things to do while they're lying on a sunbed. But we're very grateful, and keep up the good work, people.
Happy
you know?
To have you. Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Right. Welcome to all our new listeners. So this week, Pat is going to read from her work in progress. Heather is going to tell us about the word Catherine. We're going to be talking about Black history and Black writers. And Linda and Alison Brunning Robertson are going to tell us what's on their bedside table. But first, Teresa is going to ask us to...
Name the novel.
I certainly am. Get your pens ready. Well, I think this one is an easy one. And I predict Linda will get it on the first clue and possibly everybody. But let's just see.
Wow. Okay.
Originally published as a 40-part serial, when published in book form on March the 20th, 1852, the novel sold 3,000 copies on that day alone. It was the best-selling novel of the 19th century, but has become controversial for its alleged use of racial stereotypes.
I've got an inkling.
1852.
Well, that may be a little early.
I think you might be on the right line. So, clue number two. The novel was partly based on the life of Josiah Henson, an escaped slave. His home in Canada now houses a museum named after the novel. Steph's writing. Everybody else is just thinking. Okay. The novel is sometimes credited with starting the American Civil War.
Oh, it's not the one I thought, yeah.
I thought Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe. Did you get it, Linda?
No.
Why
I
not?
Was thinking about Tom Sawyer, and that's why I said, I think it's a little too early.
Yeah,
been,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought Tom Sawyer, the first clue.
Yeah.
You're not going to get this one.
So,
Wilfie, our mascot is trying to get a cookie I'm eating.
Why are you eating at work? Okay, yeah. Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. She was an ardent abolitionist and based the novel partly on published slave narratives, as well as on interviews she conducted with runaway slaves that crossed the Ohio River from Kentucky into the free North.
Mm.
But it's also often said she created these stereotypes of the black mammy nursemaid, the pickaninnies, Uncle Tom himself, the loyal, faithful servant, and so on. But so it's not without controversy, but it had a massive, massive impact, as you can see from the sales. You know, to change people's attitude to slavery and to be part of that fight for abolition.
I'm just sitting here wondering how they did the marketing to get everyone to buy when the book first came out like that.
Well,
without any word of mouth.
You think marketing was invented in the 21st century? No, I mean, the serialisation was the thing.
Yes.
People then wanted the volumes.
Together.
Usually, often in the 19th century, they came out in three volumes or two volumes. And early in the 19th century, most people couldn't really afford books, or the wealthier people would pay to a shilling or something a week for a subscription library and so on. But then stories were read aloud and passed around. I don't know how much it cost on publication, actually, but it must have been fairly cheap, I reckon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks very much, Teresa. So now Pat is going to read to us from her work in progress. We're going to catch up on what's happening with Mark, Marianne and Peter.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll be glad to hear, getting towards the end. This is the point where Peter, having had
a stroke as a result of, partly as a result of being pushed aside by Mark. Has just come home from, well, has recently come out of hospital. He's been in hospital recuperating for about 3 months or so. And Mark is beginning to feel that he's losing that closeness he had with Mariana, because now all her attention is focused back on Peter. And plus Mark is worrying about Peter's progress, because so far he doesn't remember, Peter doesn't have any memory of what happened to him, and Mark is concerned that if he does improve much more, he'll start to remember, and then that's it for him, mm-hmm. he thinks. And he's, the main thing that worries him about it is the change that he thinks he will see in Mariana if she knows the truth about it. Tears welled, telling Mariana, seeing her expression change, feeling her pull away from him, even if she was kind, understanding, forgiving, he couldn't bear it. She would never feel the same about him. How could she? No. She must never know. He couldn't let that happen. Peter continued to improve. He had a weekly physiotherapy appointment at the hospital, and Mariana made sure he did his exercises daily. Mark watched Peter's progress anxiously. He would have to do something soon, or everything would be ruined. But what? Any sort of accident in the house, or even in the garden, would be sure to arouse suspicion, given his history. No, whatever happened needed to take place elsewhere, where the chances of a random accident were more likely. But the only time Peter left the house was for the weekly visit to the hospital. A taxi picked them up and then brought them back. Door-to-door service. However, it was on one of these trips that Mark began to see a glimmer of hope. They were on their way back from the hospital after a particularly successful session. Peter had taken two steps unaided. Mariana clapped her hands in delight. "Oh, my darling, that is marvellous! You will be running a marathon soon." And they all laughed, except Mark. All the way back in the taxi, Mariana chattered excitedly about Peter's progress, how he would soon be back to his old self. "But not so old," she laughed, patting his knee. "We should celebrate," she cried. "I know, we will stop for tea and cakes at Fletcher's, just like we used to." Mark had heard all about their weekly outings to the cafe in the village, with the cream cakes to die for, and the dark, rich, hot chocolate that reminded Mariana of her youth in Hungary. "You don't want to tire him out," replied Mark, resentment sharpening his voice. "Nonsense. You would love it, wouldn't you, my darling? We can sit outside in the sunshine and pretend we are in Budapest." Peter managed a lopsided smile and a strangled yes. Mark's stomach contracted as he watched her stroking Peter's hand. Fletcher's was one of a small parade of shops that formed what the locals called the village, even though it was only 100 yards or so from the main road into Manchester. The driver turned off that same road, pulled up outside the cafe and lowered the access ramp. While Mariana paid him, Mark jumped out and prepared to guide Peter's wheelchair onto the pavement. He steadied it down the ramp, and it was only as he felt the pull as Peter reached the end of the ramp that he realised just how much of an incline they were on. Glancing back to the road, seeing the traffic speeding past, he had the beginnings of an idea. "Isn't this wonderful?" Mariana's voice interrupted his thoughts as she headed to the small silver tables glinting in the sun. "And there is plenty of room for your wheelchair. I will go and order, my darling. They will be so pleased to see us again. Mark, what would you like? Oh, you must have a cake." Her joy was a knife in his side.
Oh, what a cliffhanger. And things have taken a very sinister turn.
They have indeed,
yes.
Doesn't that learn? he's not going to do it. I just know he won't do anything to
the very
Peter.
Fact he's even considering the idea. So
I love that last line.
I've got a conceptual issue with this, and I just wonder if there's some there's something you've written or you're intending to write that it's missing in the middle.
Probably.
Because I'm not understanding why he's feeling this all so keenly. It almost feels to me like there's some sort of, not a sexual pull towards her, but he seems to be very needy towards Marianne, and I'm missing why.
I think it's because he didn't have much of a... Because he lost his grand.
But if he's feeling all that, then why would he be plotting to kill her husband? It just doesn't add up for
because
me.
Because he feels if Peter recovers... She will tell Marianna about his past, and that's what
happened.
He doesn't have enough faith in Marianna's compassion and humanity that she would be able to say, you know, okay, you did a bad thing, but you've been to jail, and now you're not that person anymore. Mm-hmm. But he is. Yeah. I feel Marianna would have the compassion. Yeah. To get past that, I feel that she would. I'd like to believe that she would.
Perhaps what's missing for me is just a description of the time they've spent. More of a description of the time they spent together when Peter was in hospital.
Yeah,
I mean, I do remember you reading a bit about it, but it wasn't enough for me to be able to buy into this.
It was like
this.
A summary, wasn't it?
Yes.
You need to have a description of the more bonding.
Yes, I think so. And then apart from that, it was all... I mean, the writing's absolutely great. Absolutely loved all the writing. The only bit I picked up on was they all laughed except Mark. So then it would be... They both laughed, wouldn't it? Or I sort of knew where you were coming from.
No, because the physiotherapist...
Okay.
Yeah. I think what's confusing, because I thought the same as you, I almost said, no, they both laughed. But in fact, if you go back, they were on their way back from the hospital after a particularly successful session. That puts us in the taxi.
Yes.
That's why we think
that's
just the
thing.
Peter had taken two steps unaided. Marianna clapped her hands in delight. Oh, my darling, they all laughed except Mark. That's not in.
Yeah.
That's not during the journey back from the hospital.
No,
so I think that's the problem.
That is the problem,
So that just needs a little bit of...
Just to go to the point that Nicola's made about wanting a little bit more... witness the bonding a little bit more. I felt, you know, where you have Mark watched Peter's progress anxiously, he would have to do something. I think you could, if you could expand that and write it as a show and let us feel the tension building. You know what we've talked about writing the fast bit slow and the slow bits fast?
Yeah.
I think actually that we could actually have a lot of detail that shows us that the tension is rising and that he's feeling uncomfortable. So, you know, watching Peter's progress, that's quite a...
And also that when Peter is home from hospital, Marianna, he's taking up Marianna's time, which actually he wants for himself, Mark wants for himself.
Which we can't actually see. We can only kind of assume that it's happened, but so I think I think if you could expand that bit and have Peter and have us with Mark watching Peter's progress and watching Marianna clucking over him and watching Peter manage to sit up, and I mean, I love the image of Marianna going, "Oh, well done, darling, well done." But I think a bit more of that in the house would,
and perhaps would be sometimes good. He thinks Peter's looking at him and trying to say something to him.
Maybe he would test Peter's memory by saying to him, you know, something about, oh, we did this and that and the other, remember? And Peter would say, or Peter might...
He could take him for daily walks around the garden to test him.
Yeah, he could.
No, I just think watching his progress anxiously... I'd like to see that a bit more than just being told that he's watching his progress. And I think that would... I know that this was a short story. It's now a novella. But
I did notice in Waterstones this summer that they had tables and featuring novellas.
This is the thing. People are reading more, I think, than they have before, but also they want something they can read on the way to work in a commute. So sometimes a short story isn't quite long enough, or they want something that they can read this week on it, on their commute or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does seem to be the novella's having a resurgence, and maybe we should look into that for a future.
That's a good idea. Good idea.
But, yeah, I mean, I think there are some lovely, you know, resentment sharpening his voice.
Yes, I love
that. That's really good.
Yeah.
His stomach contracted as he watched her stroking Peter's hand. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
And the knife, her joy being like a knife to him with the cake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, you know, the whole thing about the cake is lovely. Lovely image.
The
that.
Knife on the side. Yeah.
The rich hot chocolate reminding you of Budapest.
Yeah.
Never been to Hungary. Never actually been to Vienna, but I always associate. Vienna with hot chocolate and
cakes
and things.
Let's go do a bit of research.
Yes, let's all go to Budapest and we can hang out in the baths as well. It's full of spas and
things. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that's right. Are they the Turkish baths there, right?
They have sort of hot baths, cold baths.
Oh, ladies. I'm supposed to be the chairman. Pulling you to order.
And I am.
Linda, you've got some comments by the looks of you.
Yeah, I have. I was in here when... she reminds him, or she says, oh, you'd love it, my darling, and we can sit outside, etc. And Peter managed a lopsided smile and a strangled yes. Has Peter been, I don't remember that Peter was talking very much. Has he talked before, or is this something new for him?
I sort of described that she glossed movement on the side and wasn't able to speak very clearly.
Right.
So.
Okay. So he's...
I haven't had him speaking.
Okay. But he can speak.
Yeah.
But again, this would ratchet up Mark's anxiety that he said yes. You know, he's recovering.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so...
Yeah.
And it could actually be included. That's the first thing he said or the first thing he heard. Or,
Well, that's basically my only question. But I like the way you've talked about Fletcher's being... part of a small parade of shops, you know. That was a lovely phrase, I think. Well, I studied the thing about Peter's wheelchair going down the ramp and onto the pavement. And the sentence says, he steadied it down the ramp, and it was only as he felt the pull as Peter reached the end of the... the two as phrases, I thought it kind of threw me there for a minute.
And I'd like to know if is the downward slope at the end of the ramp at right angles or carrying on straight?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I did spend a certain amount of time writing this, looking at taxis with disabled access, some of which they go through the back.
On a hill, onto a hill.
Yeah. Others would come out at the side, but then you've still got a slope down. Uh-huh. But then I've got the logistics of how can you have tables and chairs outside the cafe if it's on slope. But I'll resolve that.
Yes. Well, it's a terraced cafe, obviously.
I just saw it as one of those, and they're not on the sidewalk, I don't think, but... like a van opens and then they put lower down a ramp that slopes from the van to the pavement.
The side of the van or the back of the van?
Rolling him, huh?
Side of the van or the back of the van?
I thought it was on the side. They opened one of those big side doors.
Well, you can get either or.
And then instead of one of those platform that lowers, I mean, it's a ramp that goes down and that's the slope.
But isn't this a wonderful example of how... you know, something as simple as getting somebody out of a taxi and onto a ramp and down and feeling the pull of the wheelchair starting to run away from you, how even though it's your story and it's complete fiction, you've got to make sure that it works within the laws of physics.
How about there's a sort of a parking bay and the cafe chairs would then be behind the taxi on the wider pavement, let's say, if there's a parking bay and that's all double yellow lines. Mm-hmm. And that could be where the slope down is.
I think we need a diagram. The approach of the taxi, the parking area.
Where gradient of the road.
The gradient of the road.
Well, why don't we just rent a handicapped accessible van?
Try it.
Push each other down.
Brilliant.
Kill somebody.
Let's just kill somebody.
Bagsy be the one who doesn't get pushed down the ramp.
I spent quite a lot of time
researching how to kill somebody. It's the darker side of being a writer, isn't it?
It is, indeed.
Well, I didn't have a problem with it because I envisioned just this little sloping ramp going out of the side of the van. They fold it back up in there when they're done, etc. I didn't think the slope was in the landscape there at all.
Oh, there has to be a hill. There has to be a hill so you can let the wheelchair go down.
You realise how much of an incline they were on. Oh, I see, yeah, it doesn't...
But I thought it's not the ramp itself is inclined, and he's rolling him down that to the sidewalk. Which is
yes, but then when he
where's
hits the bottom...
Where's the peril in that?
Yeah. Oh, my God, I've enjoyed this discussion so much. Thank you very much, Pat, and thank you, everyone, for your feedback and logistical input.
And if anybody has a brilliant idea about how to manage that in terms of physics and logistics, please answer some postcard.
I think you're onto it. I mean, you know, it ruined my fictive dream a little bit while I had to sit and puzzle it out, but I definitely think you're onto it, the fact that he comes down the ramp and then he feels the pull of the hill. So he's got to be going down a ramp onto an ongoing slope, hasn't he?
Yeah.
But that, he, you know, so easy to let go.
I think it's probably going to work best if he comes out of the back of
it. Yeah. It was his motivation that was bothering me more, though.
So rear entrance, and then the actual cafe tables would be in front of the parking. Yeah.
But he's not going to kill him.
Well, we don't know yet. No. Anyway, I'm the chairman, and I have to take charge because fun as this is, we are rattling on a bit. We're going to go on to Heather now, who's going to show us some insight into the word Catherine, which is also your daughter's name.
It certainly is. I decided I'd try and be clever this week and do some research and sit down with some books. So I googled mispronounced words, thinking back to before the summer when we talked about mischievous and mischievous. So I thought that'd be clever and I'd find some, you know, clever words to think about. And I found a book... and it's called You're Saying It Wrong, a pronunciation guide to the 150 most commonly mispronounced words and their tangled histories of misuse. So I thought, oh, I can use something there. And then I found an article by somebody called Catherine Brooks offering the 12 best. The people who wrote the book were Catherine and Ross Patras. And Catherine... and Catherine were both spelled differently. So, that's strange. I wonder how many ways there are to spell the name Catherine. So I looked at it. I did find out the name originated from the Greek Ekaterina, which is of uncertain etymology. The earliest known use of the Greek name is the reference to St. Catherine of Alexandria. The theory that the name comes from Hecate, which is the name of the Greek goddess of magic.
Hecate the witch.
It's regarded by editors of the Oxford Dictionary of First Name Terms as unconvincing. So, in the early Christian era, it became associated with the Greek adjective kathos, meaning pure. The name was first recorded in England in 1196, after being brought back from the Crusades. And it made me curious about how many variations there are, considering that in Britain and in the US, its variants have been among the 100 most popular names since 1880. And I found a huge list. Catherine, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, my daughter's the way she spells it. Catherine with an A, C-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E. C-A-T-H-R-Y-N.
That's my Catherine.
K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E. Catherine, with, as you say, Kate, with K-A-T-H-R-Y-N.
That's my daughter.
And there were pages and pages and pages of other variations of the word. And so I just thought, put it out to our listeners and everybody, are there any rules on how you spell people's names?
Oh, my Lord, if there were, they threw them out in the last 50 years.
Well, in France, there used to be a list, I think right up until the 1970s, or perhaps more recently, of names that you were allowed to call
children.
Same
in Iceland, it's still there now.
There's a list of names that you
And they had to be like a saint's name. But obviously, French society has changed somewhat in the last 30, 40 years, and I think that no longer is the case. But there was a prescribed list. I don't know. In England, I don't think there are rules as such. Spelling has been, you know, as Pat's talked about before, it's taken a long while for spelling to settle down. Mm. But people like to vary things for their children. They want to give their children something unique, so they create a different spelling.
Yeah. I've just read a book by Adam Kay, Secret Diaries of a Junior Doctor. It's called This Is Going to Hurt. And there's an entry that he made in his diary, which I shall read to you because I found it quite amusing. But just before I read it, just to say, all doctors have a duty enshrined in their General Medical Council code to protect children and young people from abuse and neglect. And this is what he says. It's a great shame our child protection duties don't extend to vetoing some of the terrible names parents saddle their unfortunate babies with. This morning I delivered little baby S-A-Y-T-O-N, pronounced Satan, as in King of the Underworld. It's hard to believe he'll get through his school career unbullied, and yet we merrily wave him off on that journey. Or maybe he is actually the devil and I should have just shoved him back in. At lunch, I had a fierce discussion with my colleague Katie as to whether my run-in with baby Satan is better or worse than the one that she delivered called, and I'll spell it, L-E-S-A-N-Y-A, pronounced lasagna. As in lasagna. We regularly compare horror stories like we're paying top trumps obstetrics. She tells me that she once pulled out a baby girl called Clive. And though I point out we've got a Princess Michael, so that's not particularly impressive. Yeah. Oliver says that where he was born in Iceland, names must be picked from a specific list from which it's illegal to deviate. And that doesn't sound like the worst idea. So Satan and lasagna.
A friend who's a health visitor said to a young mum, she saw the name written down and she said, so how are you pronouncing this name? And she said, Chinese. Obviously, it was Chinese, C-H-I-N-E-S-E. It was going on this child's birth certificate. Chinese.
And coming back to the topic of Black History Month, let's hear from Heather, because you've done some research about how it all came about, didn't
you? Yes, just a little bit. I've got to say, when it was first mentioned that we're going to talk about Black History Month, I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of it as a, you know, an idea or something that happened. And I've got to confess that I thought, does it matter? Am I being naive, or does it matter what colour somebody is? If they're a writer, surely it's the writing that's important and not their ethnicity or the heritage or anything else. And thought about myself, I was born in Moss Side in Manchester, which is a very, very deprived, rough area with a very, back in the 1950s, a very high, non-UK residence. And I lived there until I was 10. And it was truly multiracial. And I went round to tea at friends' house and ate Chinese food and, you know, sort of Asian food and all sorts of things. And it was only when I moved to an area that was predominantly white that I understood I had been very privileged to be part of that society. Right. So I thought, right, let's find out about Black History Month. Stop being critical and do something about it. And I read, Carter G. Woodson established Negro History Week in 1926. He realised the importance of providing a theme to focus the intention of the public. The intention has never been to dictate or limit the exploration of the Black experience, but to bring to the public's attention important developments that merits emphasis. Mm. He hoped the week would acknowledge the history of Black people and their contributions to society. Still to this day, the month is designed to recognise Black history and achievements. And I felt better, I think, then. I wasn't quite so critical about it. So I had no idea whether any of the authors I've read were Black. So I, again, started to look through things. And I found an article, now I don't know how I'm going to say this, it's in The Guardian by Irenison Okoji. And she referred to somebody called Simi Bedford and her novel Yoruba Girl Dancing. And it's the semi-autobiographical account of somebody coming from Nigeria to an English boarding school. And I thought that sounded fascinating. Mm. And I wanted to be even more impressive and get the book and tell you I was reading it and tell you all about it. And I'm very sorry, it's coming by snail mail. So it could take quite some time before it actually arrives.
Right, right. Yeah. It does sound interesting.
Well, then we get
it. Yeah, we can all borrow it if it's a proper book, aren't we?
Thanks for looking into that for us.
Would you say again the name of the person who started the Black History Month?
Carter G. Woodson.
Carter G. Woodson.
Carter Woodson.
Oh, you mean with C-A-R-T-E-R, Carter.
Yeah.
E-R, Carter.
Yeah.
No, that's not what you said.
I said you didn't say it with an American accent.
I said Carter.
Carter.
It was C-A-R-T-A, Carter. That's what
Carter G. Woodson.
Thank you.
In 1926.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you're in there you said that you weren't you didn't know if any of the books you've read were by Black authors. Has anyone got any books that they definitely know are by Black authors?
Yeah, I've read lots of books by Black authors, but one that I particularly enjoyed, Mallory Blackman, who was the Children's Laureate for some years in the UK. She wrote a series of books called Noughts and Crosses. I don't know if you remember those. Probably
didn't realise it was a series. I thought there
were four. Books. Okay. Started with Noughts and Crosses, and then there were three other books that followed on. And it's a story of a society where there are noughts and crosses.
Zeros and X's,
yes.
For the Americans. Yeah.
Okay. In the UK, we call them noughts and crosses, okay. And because we play noughts and crosses and you play tic-tac. So in the book, one group of people are deemed crosses and the others are deemed noughts.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's a euphemism for colour because she doesn't tell you which is the Black community and which is the white community until a long way through. But it is actually a study...
Mm-hmm.
Of Black and white, and she tells a kind of Romeo and Juliet love story of a nought and a cross who fall in love, teenagers who fall in love, and it's obviously because they come from the other sides of the community, it's frowned upon. So I really, really enjoyed those books, but I don't think I read them in any way because she was Black and I wanted to read about the Black experience. I mean, I tend not to choose books. I just choose books because I like the look of them.
They sound interesting.
But obviously, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I've read her books, and she writes about her world, writes what she knows, and is incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, that's why it's important to have different voices from all kinds of different backgrounds, isn't it? And I think we all read over quite a wide range of authors and materials, and we're not picking a white author or a Black author, but we're looking for stuff that's interesting, challenging, or that's being talked about, that people are recommending. So, but I think it's really, I think that the Black History Month, although it's not predominantly about writing as such, it's about, forgotten figures, in history or that have been neglected by the mainstream, let's say. Yeah.
And I was far more comfortable with understanding that it was about culture.
Yeah.
It was about maybe the people that were forgotten that did have a big contribution or made a big contribution to society.
Yeah.
And they've been kind of, skimmed over. And I felt more comfortable.
Yeah, we've talked before about Mary Seacole and figures like that who really through Black History Month have been brought into the public eye, public domain and rediscovered.
One of our earlier episodes, didn't we?
Ira Aldridge.
Aldridge
the Black American actor, the great 19th century actor, who's a great hero of mine. Yeah. So it's about that, isn't it? It's
and Mary Seacole was Jamaican?
I think she was Jamaican, yes. She ran a hotel come hospital in Jamaica, and we're talking in the sort of early 19th century, so she was brought up there. And British soldiers, this hotel was set up for British soldiers serving in the Caribbean. And she had a very affectionate relationship with many young men who were a long way from home and a long way from their mothers and so on. And she nursed them and she ran this hotel and fed them. And she went to the Crimea as well and set up a hotel there. She also, I think, claimed she had a ring which she claimed came from Horatio Nelson. She claimed some sort of descent or connection with Horatio Nelson, I think. But yeah, but she wrote her autobiography, which I can't quite remember the title of, but I did read it earlier this year. But a very interesting figure.
Yeah, but she was a character who'd been basically whitewashed out of history.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, as we know, history is written by the victors. History is written by the people who are in control of the media, it's important to let's hear some other voices that aren't necessarily represented in the mainstream.
Well, while thinking, obviously, because I don't know, you know, until you don't know, do you, unless there's a picture on the back of the book of the author. So I started thinking about my favourite black authors that I knew about, and Hanif Qureshi came up because we've mentioned him on previous episodes. And he wrote lots of books. I was amazed how many books he had. He's a playwright, he's a screenwriter, filmmaker and novelist of Pakistani and English descent. And he was included by the Times in their list of the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Buddha of Suburbia, obviously we'd mentioned on a previous episode. Very good. It was on television, I remember. It was very groundbreaking at the time. Yeah. And then My Beautiful Laundrette, of course, which we all remember from Daniel Day-Lewis doing something gorgeous with the top, taking his top off. it was about a gay couple, and you didn't know that till the end, I don't think. And they ended up, Daniel Day-Lewis playing a street punk, and the Omar being the young protagonist, whose uncle, is it uncle? Yes, his uncle Nasser. Owned a laundrette, and the two find happiness running the laundrette. But the British Film Institute ranked My Beautiful Laundrette the 50th greatest British film of the 20th century. Hanif Qureshi, not to be sniffed at.
Could you spell it?
Well, I can give you this bit of paper to take home if you like.
No, why don't you spell it for the readers?
We'll put
links on.
I think with the Buddha of Suburbia, which is the book of his that I've read, it's groundbreaking in so many ways because it's breaking away from those stereotypes because you've got sort of middle class Pakistani family and the father gets involved with a white neighbour who sees him as some sort of guru, and he plays this role of this guru.
Eastern guru.
Yeah, and also the sexuality in it as well.
It's very sexy books. Yeah. Very funny books too. I remember the humour.
The protagonist falls in love with the son of this woman, and it's about the sexual explorations and so on. So
lots of very strong secondary characters in there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What have you got, Linda?
Oh well, I was going to talk about Langston Hughes. He's and I've read some of his books. He was part of the Harlem Renaissance, and when he was writing, I think he was one of the ones that was kind of not in favor of integration. There were some people of color who really didn't like the idea of having their culture diluted by sending their kids to white schools, which were supposed to be better than theirs or whatever. And a lot of people objected to that. And I think he got a lot of criticism through the early years of his career for, in fact, he was called at one point the poet laureate of Harlem. And then those who disparage him called him the poet low rate.
Oh, right.
But he wrote, I think he wrote 11 plays, and I can't remember how many books he wrote, and he has an awful lot of poetry, and I've known him, and I think most people, primarily as a poet. He also wrote, I think, with Zora Neale Hurston. They wrote together, I think, a story or two. But that was an interesting time and place in the Harlem Renaissance.
What period are you talking
read about? I think it was in the 20s and 30s, I believe.
Same time as it all kicking off in Paris. Intellectually speaking.
Was it?
The jazz and everything all mixed up together.
Mm. Mm. He had a poem, his poem called, it's really Harlan, but then I think it's a dream deferred is probably another
what
title.
What happens to a dream deferred?
Yeah, I'm
does
read it to you.
Dry
you
know? Oh, sorry.
You're going to recite it to us there, Teresa.
No, sorry, I won't.
I am just totally always amazed at the breadth of Teresa's knowledge of literature.
Wide, but very shallow.
But the fact that she remembers all these things is amazing. Well, anyway, it's... and the second line here, or the third line in this, is like a raisin in the sun. And the play, A Raisin in the Sun, the name was taken from this poem.
Was that Lorraine Hansberry?
It was Lorraine Hansberry who did the play, yeah. So I'll read you what happens to a dream deferred. Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? And it's really short, and it's a pithy little thing, but I think the way it's, I just never get into sometimes until you've read it many times and given it a lot of thought. Yeah. You don't really get into what all the things he's doing. For example, a raisin in the sun. A raisin is a fruit that was juicy at one time, and nutritious, and then it dries up and becomes useless. You know?
No, it's lovely, dried raisins. Really? Raisins are lovely.
but I think...
But it seems... Yeah.
I think he's referring to... black aspirations and the young people with their dreams and aspirations, which the wider society doesn't really have space for.
That's right, and he's and also the thing about the rotten meat. You know, it says that there's something rotten in the state of forgotten dreams. And then you get the heavy load, the sagging down. Who wants to carry all of this weight? And
who wants to carry dreams that you think will never be fulfilled?
Right. Mm. Everyone has baggage, it says, but doesn't history show some people have always carried more than others?
But also, isn't there also there in the final line, there's not a threat necessarily, but the idea that actually if you keep repressing people's dreams and keep holding them back, something's going to explode.
That's right.
I've got to say, the style of that, when I was doing the poetry course, they kept sending us off to find poems we liked, and sent us to a great resource where, you know, you could just look at poems and follow the links through. And there were some very powerful black female poets on that I discovered quite by accident, who wrote in that similar sparse style. Very evocative.
But I really admire what he's done. I really like reading his stuff. I had at one point, my books have gone hither and yon through the years. I had his 2-volume set of his biography, and well, this is his many of his poems. Mm. Of course, all of his work wouldn't fit because he's written prolifically through the years.
I think he wrote a short story called Sunny's Blues. I hope it was him that wrote it, because it's the most beautiful story and the most moving. Absolutely stayed with me over the years.
Mm-hmm. Because he did write, I think, got involved with jazz movements, and he wrote a lot of things that had to do with music. So it's very, and he has another book, something about blues. Yeah. I can't remember what it was now, But anyway.
Pat, what about you?
Toni Morrison.
Oh, yes.
But I think probably my favourite Black author would be Maya Angelou. Mentioned her a few weeks back in the I know why the cage bird sings. And it isn't so much the writing, if I'm honest, it's just her.
Her personality is wonderful. Isn't
totally
it?
Inspirational. Yeah.
I feel so sorry for skinny women. I can't say it like she does, but she just gives it so much sex. You know.
Yeah.
She'd have been 90 if she'd lived this year. She was born in 28. But when I was sort of looking at the information, some more information about her, it's just the amount of stuff that she's done. Apart from the 7 volumes of autobiography, she had 3 books of essays, several books of poetry. She was an actor, a writer, director of television, film.
Amazing.
She had, and although she had very little formal education, she was awarded 50 honorary degrees in various places.
Mm.
She was only the 2nd person to poet to be invited to give the inaugural address poem, which she did for Clinton, and the first woman. The first one was Robert Frost, did Kennedy's.
They're the only 2 poets that did it. Is that what you must be true. I have no idea.
But interestingly, poetry critics have sort of said that her poetry is much better in performance.
Than in
the
written form.
I quite often find that with poetry.
Yeah. She is a performance poet.
Yes.
Because she has that sort of background. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that she came from sort of very sort of modest beginnings. She wasn't like dirt poor or anything, but she had a very sort of dramatic childhood in lots of ways.
Absolutely terrible.
And encountered all sorts of obstacles in her life. And not only overcame them, but became this major figure.
Yeah.
With influence, who influenced all sorts of people. It was, just I met her once.
Ooh, did you?
Well,
I have to say.
Where?
In Milwaukee.
Wow.
I worked there for a year.
Okay.
And she was invited to address, not the school I was working at, but one of the other schools. I only met her to sort of briefly afterwards. Wasn't that we were at a social event together or anything, she was one of those people that you could just listen to and she lit up a room.
Star quality.
Fabulous.
Star quality, very much so, I think.
Thank you.
I do like Still I Rise, which is her most famous. I still like that.
Now, Teresa, what's that you're thrusting in front of me?
Well, I was going to just say something about Zora Neale Hurston, as Linda mentioned her in connection with Langston Hughes. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read Zora Neale Hurston before, and I've just read Their Eyes Are Watching God. So I just wanted to introduce this novel to people who may not know it. I'm sure most people in America know it very well. But this is the story of a character called Janie, from girl to woman, really, her search for fulfilment, her desire to live and experience life. And I love the way that she writes of these the black communities. She shows the joy and the fun in their life as well as the hardship. And for many years she was out of print and neglected, partly because she didn't fit the political agenda of the Harlem Renaissance or other movements who not wanted to show black people as victims, but were not happy with her portrayal of black people could be happy in this oppressive society. Mm. Can I read a little bit? Because it's a very lovely book. And she's talking in this bit about the sexual awakening of Janie. She's sitting under a pear tree. She's about 16. It was a spring afternoon in West Florida. Janie had spent most of the day under a blossoming pear tree in the backyard. She'd been spending every minute that she could steal from her chores under that tree for the last 3 days. That was to say, ever since the first tiny bloom had opened. It had called her to come and gaze on a mystery. From barren brown stems to glistening leaf buds, from leaf buds to snowy virginity of bloom. It stirred tremendously. How? Why? It was like a flute song forgotten in another existence, and remembered again. What? How? Why? This singing she heard that had nothing to do with her ears. The rose of the world was breathing out smell. It followed her through all her waking moments and caressed her in her sleep. It connected itself with other vaguely felt matters that had struck her outside observation and buried themselves in her flesh. Now they emerged and quested about her consciousness. She was stretched on her back beneath the pear tree, soaking in the alto chant of the visiting bees, the gold of the sun and the panting breath of the breeze, when the inaudible voice of it all came to her. She saw a dust-bearing bee sink into the sanctum of a bloom. The thousand sister calyxes arched to meet the love embrace, and the ecstatic shiver of the tree from root to tiniest branch, creaming in every blossom and frothing with delight. Mm. So this was a marriage. Mm. She had been summoned to behold a revelation. Then Janie felt a pain, remorseless sweet, that left her limp and languid. Now that's how to write about sex, isn't it? But she was out of print and neglected, friend. And then in the early 70s was kind of rediscovered, and Alice Walker, who was a university teacher at that time, was appalled to discover that she was buried in an unmarked grave, having been a Pulitzer Prize winner and an anthropologist and a prolific author. Yeah. So she went in search of the grave, and she wrote an essay about it, and she was very much being talked about in universities at that time. And then there was a sort of campaign to get the book reissued because people wanted to buy it. So she was rediscovered in the 70s.
But so you recommend it?
Yeah, I want to read everything she's written.
I praise indeed. Beautiful picture on the front as
well. It's a lovely edition. It's the perennial classic, which has a very good introduction as well.
So. Yeah.
Nice.
My Sundoku just got one bit bigger.
Oh, another one. Mine's groaning. Right, well, it's almost time to end Write Club, the podcast, for this week. But before we go, there's just time for Linda and Alison Brunning Robertson to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Linda, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm reading a book by Jodi Picoult, who's a very prolific author. Those has many, many fans, especially, I think, in America, maybe all over. But I read a book here called Small Great Things. And it's a very interesting novel having to do with racial issues about a nurse, a black nurse who works in a hospital on the labor and delivery floor. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone if you want to read it, and I certainly recommend that you read it. But she's run afoul of a white supremacist. And a trial ensues. All I can tell you is that, without giving everything away, that Jodi said, first of all, she wanted to write this for a long time, but she was concerned because it deals with a person of color, and she didn't know, is this my story to write? Do I have a right to do this or not?
Okay, so on to Alison Brunning Robertson, who is, of course, our short story prize winner.
My name is Alison Robertson, and today I've been reading May. May is by Naomi Kruger, and I have to have a confession here that Naomi is a former colleague of mine, so that when I read May, I was a little bit worried that I wasn't going to like it, but I would have to say that I did. Thankfully, I think it's brilliant. It's about May, who's an elderly lady with dementia, and it's the story of a day in her life. It's kind of written in a lyrical stream of consciousness, so we experience her fragmented memories of a red-haired boy who is lost to her. The mystery of May's past is revealed through voices and memories of those close to her, her late husband Arthur, daughter Karen, Grant and Alex, and her care assistant, Afsana. It's not narrated in sequence, but shifts viewpoints, and they allow us to accumulate an insight into May. What I like most about the book, though, is the richly detailed lives of those narrators, and I'd love to read more of each individual's lives, especially the care assistant, Afsana. These richly detailed lives are made very concrete through cultural references, for example, Sunday dinners, football matches, holidays in Wales, and they're very vivid and sensory rendered. I find them recognisable because I'm from that part of the world and also from the same time as one of the narrators, so it became a book about my memory as well, and that's why I particularly like the book, because it brought back and invoked my own sense of fragmented memories. The book is published by a very small publisher, Seren, and I like to support small publishers when I'm reading books, and I think that this particular book, May, should have a wide audience.
Thanks very much, Alison. That was fantastic. And now we're going to just remind you all Come over and find us at on Facebook, at our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. There's a page and a group. Choose the group. And if you could subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher, every new show will be automatically delivered wherever you want it. And help us to grow even further by telling one friend about Write Club the Podcast. Thanks very much, everyone.
Bye.